Okay, Boker Tov, everybody. It's a Rhyme Tovim, Erev Tov, and welcome. And it's a pleasure to welcome back Rachel. And I know, as you heard, she's, I think more than many of us, perhaps, she feels the terrible, you know, tragedy going on in Ukraine now. But hopefully in the Schut of Torah, what can we say? Things can hopefully get better, and we should hear good news. And in the meantime, listen, we're going to learn on Makot Bechorot, Egypt. It didn't look so good in Egypt, and Purim is coming up next week. The Geula happens, Keherifying sometimes. In the blink of an eye, we go Miyagon the Simcha, so let's hope that happens. And today's topic, freedom, fear. I think that's very appropriate. Freedom, fear, and time, chapters 11 to 13 in Sefer Shmot, the killing of the firstborn. Okay, Vakasha, Rachel.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Kalman. Thank you, everybody, for coming. And without further ado, let us delve in. We talked last week at length about the first nine plagues, or makot, as we call them in Hebrew, hits, being hit. And we saw how they're all building up to not just forcing the Egyptians to let the Jews out, because that God could have done in 2 seconds if he chose to, but rather to dismantling the whole worldview, the whole system of morals and ethics and religion and power structures that underpinned the Israelites' enslavement in Egypt. God is challenged, is making war on a worldview, on Paro as a representative of an entire world, not on Paro the man alone. And then in our week's Parsha, God is informing Moshe and Aaron that this is it, that they've come to the final moment. All of those things that God sowed, that God built up, are about to come into fruition. And before we see what actually happens, I'd like to look together at how God describes it beforehand, informing them of what's about to happen. So it's a long passage. It's 8 verses here in the beginning of chapter 11, but we're going to read a little bit, pause, read a little bit, and pause. And God said to Moses, I will bring but one more plague upon Paro and upon Egypt. After that, he shall let you go from here. Indeed, when he lets you go, he will drive you out of here, one and all. In Hebrew, the word he's using is garesh yigaresh. It's banish. It's a very strong word. Personally, I have to tell you, on a personal note, it reminds me of how when the Soviets arrested my father under trumped up charges of espionage for being a refusenik and a dissident. And they kept telling him, we don't let heroes leave the prison alive. And they kept him for 9 years. And then the whole world was putting so much pressure that in the end, they decided they have to let him go. And they made a spy exchange deal. Of course, my father was not a spy, but whatever, with the West. And on the way there, when my father demanded to understand where they're taking him, they said, well, we decided to banish you from the Soviet Union. You, for behavior that doesn't become a Soviet citizen, you are thereby banished. And he's like, that's all I've been asking for. You think it's a punishment for me? But it reminds me of that tone that God is telling them. He's not just going to let you go. He's going to push you out. He's going to usher you out. He's going to realize that the last thing he wants is for you to be. And then God gives them instructions. The first instruction he gives them is this. Tell the people to borrow, each man from his neighbor and each woman from hers, objects of silver and gold. God disposed the Egyptian favorably toward the people. Moreover, Moses himself was much esteemed in the land of Egypt among Paro's couriers and among the people. So God gives this instruction. He says, borrow money, borrow actual physical valuable goods. And we're also informed that this borrowing is going well because the people are predisposed to do things to please the Israelites and Moshe. And this already tells us, even without God telling us that the plagues are about to hit their crescendo and achieve their goal, it's telling us that God's campaign have worked. Because God's campaign was about convincing the Egyptians that Paro is not the power they should trust. God's campaign was about convincing the Egyptians as well as the Israelites that there's something beyond that system that they live in, the closed system we discussed last time of tax collector, farmer, army, priest, and Paro at the pinnacle of it all. There's something beyond that. And it's clear that they already feel that there's something beyond that. On the individual level, they're happy to do favors to the Jews. And yet the system holds. But now it's about to be over. And God goes on to explain to Moses what's about to happen. Moses said, "Thus says God, towards midnight, I will go forth among the Egyptians, and every male firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of Paro, who sits on his throne, to the firstborn of the slave girl who is behind the millstones, and all the firstborn of the cattle. And there shall be a loud cry in all the land of Egypt, such as had never been or will ever be again. But not a dog shall snarl at any of the Israelites, as human or beast, in order that you may know that God makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel." These are terrible words. These are terrible promises. A tragedy of untold dimensions is about to be visited upon the entire state of Egypt, the entire country of Egypt, not only on the king, who is definitely responsible for the tragedy to come, but even on animals who can't have a share in it, on slaves who presumably don't have much share in it either. Everybody's going to be afflicted. Every home is going to become a place of mourning. And God says this will never happen again in history. This is a one-off thing. I'm making a point here. And I'm bringing to completion, not only my project of showing the Egyptians that Paro is not God, but also the project of telling them that I, God, have the power to distinguish. We saw that already popping up in the other plagues. God makes a distinction between the animals of the Israelites and the animals of the Egyptians, between the water of the Egyptians and the water of the Israelites, and so on and so forth, all to convince them that these are not natural disasters. This is not an indiscriminating natural God. This is a very, very accurate God with a very clear plan that he is carrying out. And at this moment of tragedy, so Moshe says in God's name, will be the moment of the liberation of the Jews. Then all these couriers of yours, here we realize that Moses is talking to Paro, shall come down to me and bow low to me, saying, "Depart, you and all the people who follow you. After that, I will depart." And he left Paro's presence in hot anger. We read all of that. Let's pretend we don't know what follows. Let's pretend we're reading it for the first time. We could be excused if we read it for the first time, thinking that the next few verses are going to be God informing us, or Moses informing us, and then it happened. Sorry, the storyteller informing us. And then God, in the middle of the night, brought about these deaths of all the firstborn all over Egypt, from the king's house to the animal to the slave girl at the millstone, etc., etc. And there was a great cry as if never been in the state of Egypt, and the Jews walked out, right? I mean, it told us that that's what's about to happen. Instead, what we get is two chapters of instructions. Suddenly, instead of just following through on his actions as he did in the previous plagues, God pauses. And for the very first time, he gives instructions to the Jews that make them part of the events to come, that invite them to participate in an active way and what's about to happen to Egypt and what's about to happen to them. Let's see it in the text. I'm here in box two. God said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, "This month shall mark for you the beginning of the months. It shall be the first of the month of the year for you." I want to pause here for a second before we talk about what they're supposed to do in this month and point out that this is a very crucial moment in our history as a people. The commentators point out that God says, "Hachodesh hazeh," this month. And they say, why is he saying hazeh, this? And he says, whenever the word hazeh is used in Hebrew, it means that somebody is pointing to something. Somebody is actually showing you something. And in this case, God is showing Moses the moon and says, this moon, this is what the moon looks like when you start counting a month. And on this, when this moon is up, this month that we're about to start now, this will be the first month. And the commentators and the sages before them go further to say that this, in fact, implies the very first commandment that we receive as a people. Most of the commandments we receive later, in Mount Sinai and after Mount Sinai, and we'll discuss some of that in the weeks to come. But on this moment, when we're still in Egypt, when the plagues project isn't complete, we receive the very first commandment. And the commandment we receive, the responsibility that's bestowed upon us as a people, is the responsibility that later the court, the Jewish court, the Sanhedrin carried out of declaring the month. In a sense, while God is the one who made the moon and made the moon appear, waning and appear in the way it appears, waning and waxing and so on and so forth, it is our sacred responsibility. It is our role to note when the new moon rises and declare it a new month. And if people didn't see it and didn't come to testify about it to the Jewish court and the court didn't declare it a new month, it doesn't matter that the new moon rose. What matters is that we declare it. We make the time have meaning. Why is this where God begins his campaign of including us in his management of the world? Why is this the very first commandment? Remind me to get back to it at the end. This will be what we round up and tie in a bow. When we tie in a bow everything we talk about today, this will be the point that we will see actually ties everything together. But let's keep reading for now and see what else happens. Because God doesn't stop by telling them, keep the month. He says, and now do the following. Speak to the community leadership of Israel and say that on the 10th of this month, each of them shall take a lamb to a family, a lamb to a household. You shall keep watch over it until the 14th day of this month. And all the assembled congregation of the Israelites shall slaughter it at twilight. So they're not only informed that they have to mark the new month, they're informed that once they mark the new month, a count begins. And they have things they have to do on the 10th, and they have a thing they have to do on the 14th. And everybody has to do it at the same time. Meaning it's not something Moses can do for them. They individually have to do it. I'm going on here in verse 7. They shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and the lintel of the houses in which they are to eat it. They shall eat the flesh that same night. They shall eat it roasted over the fire with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs. And it goes on with more instructions of how it should be eaten. This is how you shall eat it, your loins girded, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. And you shall eat it hurriedly. It is a Passover over offering to God. For that night I will go through the land of Egypt and strike down every male firstborn in the land of Egypt, both human and beast, and I will mete out punishments to all the gods of Egypt, and the blood, I am God, and the blood on the houses where you are staying shall be a sign for you. When I see the blood, I will pass over you so that no plague will destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. In other words, when God gives us these instructions, he's not just telling us to keep the month. He's not just telling us to do this bizarre thing and eat this bizarrely cooked offering. He's also telling us to mark our doors in some way that will protect us from him. It's almost as if God tells us, I'm going to unleash a certain power, and I'm asking you not to help me unleash it. They're not requested to go and kill anybody. But you are responsible to defend yourself. You are responsible to defend yourself because I'm giving you this power. In other words, what does it mean? It means if you don't do it, you will die. Right? Let's pause for a second to acknowledge that. He's not saying, oh, do this decorative thing. No, you have the power to protect your life. And this is a moment that requires contemplation. First of all, there's amazing power here. It gives a group of slaves who until this moment had no power over life and death, children from being thrown into the Nile, couldn't defend themselves from being beaten. It gives them the power to save their own lives. But at the same time, it's asking them to risk their lives. Because as the commentators were very quick to point out, blood is a public way above their doors. By keeping the lambs tethered in a way that everybody around them, all the Egyptians around them, could see for four whole days first, they're declaring that Moses's, and through Moses, God's instructions to them are more important to them than whatever it is the Egyptians think or whatever it is the Egyptians want. Especially when you put it in a broader context and you realize, as the commentators, again, are quick to point out, that lambs and sheep and goats were somehow sacred, sanctified to the Egyptians. They saw them as godly, divine, in some way, or symbols of divinity. It's a little hard to make that distinction when you talk about ancient Egypt, where divinity seems to be much more mixed in corporeal reality. But in some way, these lambs were presented the gods of Egypt, and the Jews had to first tether them near their homes for four whole days while all their neighbors watched over, and then slaughter them. And then not just slaughter them quietly at home where people can pretend not to see. No, slaughter them and put the blood publicly on their doors. And the question is, why? Why does God require such a risky maneuver on the part of the Israelites? Why does God require them? He could have given them the power to save their own lives in some other way. It's not as if God really needs the blood on the lintel, right? God doesn't need to peer with his monocle or his reading glasses and look at the door and say, oh, is this blood? Isn't it's ridiculous. God doesn't need it. So why make it so public? And to address this question, I want to once again swerve a little bit to the side and talk a little bit about Soviet Jewry. Today's talk is very deeply woven into my family history. And I don't do it just, you know, just for nothing. The reason is that growing up, for us, the idea that every generation we should see ourselves as if we came out of Egypt was not something metaphorical at all. My father would sit with us at the Seder wearing a kippah that somebody made for him in prison. And he would weave into the stories of historic Egypt, the one we're talking about now, the stories of the Soviet Union. And there are so many parallels in the worldview, in the system, the shape of the world as Egypt shaped it and as Soviet Union shaped it. So many similarities and what was required to break free from it, that it became ingrained in us. And when I try and understand why God requires us to draw blood on the doors, I can actually get the answer by jumping ahead to modern history. Because in many ways, every person who wanted to emigrate, every person who wanted to require an exit visa to Israel from the Soviet Union in the 60s, 70s, 80s, had to go through a very similar process. They didn't have to tie any lambs and they didn't have to play with blood or anything gruesome of that sort. But they had to make public their rejection of the public creed of the Soviet gods. The Soviets' credo was that we, the Soviet Union, are paradise of the workers. We are the best place on earth. We are just. We solve the problem of equality. We solve the problem of fraternity. Everything is perfect. We are the perfect society. For a person to come and say, I want to leave this perfect society, was tantamount to saying, I reject this claim. Now, the authorities had no intention of letting that happen. That's partly why they were so insistent on not letting people leave, people who otherwise Perhaps they would have been better off getting rid of all those troublemakers, all those people, free thinkers. Why not let them leave, right? No. But the only way they could exert their control over millions and millions of people was by everybody being too scared to stand up and say the king is naked, the emperor is naked, this is not a perfect society, we don't want to be here. You let one person say it, their neighbors get inspired. You let their neighbors say it, their neighbors get inspired. Before you know it, millions of people stand up and say, excuse me, no, we don't want that. We actually don't want that. They couldn't afford that. So they forced people to go through a very difficult process of exposing themselves to derision and danger just to apply for the visa. The first thing you had to do was get an invitation from relatives, real or fake, in Israel. Now, how do these invitations get to you? They get to you through the Soviet mail system, right? The Soviet mail system is monitored. The KGB knows about it before you even get it. Then you have to go and fill paperwork. And what kind of paperwork is required to ask for a visa from the Soviet Union? For example, you need to go and notify your workplace and get your boss to sign this form. Now, your workplace then has to make a whole show about how they are loyal Soviet citizens and don't support you. So they have to fire you and possibly also gather a meeting of all the workers for everybody to publicly condemn you. So you have to be willing to do that. You have to be willing to go through that, knowing that you're not going to find another job. And if you get refused, you're not going to get any other normal job in the Soviet Union ever. Then you had to get your parents to approve of it. And your parents sometimes had to go and get their bosses to approve of their signatures in it. So they had to expose themselves to their friends and colleagues and their derision and the dangers that come from being suspected of not being a loyal Soviet citizen. If you are a member of the Kosmosol, the Soviet youth movement, you had to get their signature also. You had to get the signature of the person responsible for the building you lived in. And so on and forth. And at every one of those places, those people had to cover their backs by making a public display of how very much they disapprove of your request, et cetera, et cetera. And then with all of that, you went and gave it to the office, to the office that handled visa, knowing all the while that you're most likely going to be refused and you're going to be stuck living with the same people, with the same neighbors, without the same job and or any other job. And this weird internal exile in the Soviet Union. In other words, and here I'm going to quote, I don't usually do it, but I'm going to quote myself in an article I wrote with my father about the topic. And I'm here in the box two, but I'm going to jump in the middle of the source. In other words, in short, every applicant had to stand in the metaphoric public square and repudiate the Soviet gods in the name of the imperialist dynasty. But here is the irony. This process that was so dangerous and so scary and disheartened and pushed many people not to apply for visas, in fact, not to try and pursue freedom for the Soviet Union, also had a liberating effect on the people who did do it. Because as I said earlier, and I think I mentioned that in previous classes also, the way an empire like the Soviet Union controls its people is through fear. They can't put everybody in prison. They need people to imprison themselves by monitoring their behavior, the words very carefully, never ever to say anything that will go against the regime. When you had to go and declare over and over and over again that you reject the Soviet credo, that you want something else, when you had to stand there while your colleagues and friends and parents yelled at you, said you're a traitor, and do it anyway, you have conquered that fear. They could never make you your own jailer again after you had already lived through that fear and come out on the other side. And so it was that the people who applied for visas, many of them talk about that, even to this day, they speak about this memory of this immense feeling of liberation. Your body is still in the Soviet Union. You might be put in prison for this, but your soul is free of fear and you can stand up and start speaking the truth of your own soul. by forcing the Israelites to put blood on their doors, by forcing the Israelites to publicly repudiate the gods of Egypt, the Egyptian way of life, by forcing them to publicly say, we are more afraid of God. We are more loyal to God than we are afraid of whatever it is you might think about us or do to us. God is forcing the Israelites to do what previous characters in the story, the two midwives, did naturally, instinctively, when they feared God more than Paro and didn't kill the males as they were born. There, it was two women acting on their own feelings. Here, God is inviting, demanding, pushing every single Israelite family to do the same. Do you remember what was the gift God gave the midwives in reward for their loyalty? Does anybody remember?
Batim.
Batim, exactly. Houses, homes. In a sense, in order to become a home, a national home, every one of us has to individually first declare that we are free from that fear, from that enslaving fear of Egypt. This is a nice idea, and it's an empowering thought, and it's nice for us sitting in 2022 in our houses in the free world to speculate about it. But how did they have the courage to actually do it? Saying that you have fear of God over fear of man is all nice and good until you have to actually stare your neighbor in the face and know that they might kill you. How did they get the courage to do that? Now, you might say that it was the fact that they already saw all the other plagues. So they already saw what God can do and how much stronger God is than the Egyptian overlords, in which case it's God already achieved his goal, right? If the goal was to pry open their horizons, pry open the systems and let people see that Paro is not the end of human existence, that it already, I think that's another reason. And that reason or that encouragement lies in what God says next. Because after giving the set of instructions, God says another rather striking thing to Moses. He says the following. I'm in books 3, Exodus 12. This day shall be to you one of remembrance. You shall celebrate it as a festival to God throughout the ages. You shall celebrate it as an institution for all. Now, God doesn't only say, oh, you will remember. He gives us instructions on exactly how we'll celebrate it. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the very first day you shall remove leaven from your houses. For whoever eats leavened bread from the first day to the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. You shall celebrate a sacred occasion on the first day and a sacred occasion on the seventh day. No more could all shall be done on them, etc., etc., etc. I'm jumping to 17. You shall observe the feast of the unleavened bread. For on this very day I brought your ranks out of the land of Egypt. You shall observe this day throughout the ages as an institution for all times. And God goes on and gives more detailed instructions on how they shouldn't eat chametz, how they should eat matzot, etc., etc. But let us pause here. For on this very day I brought your ranks out. It didn't happen yet. Just talking to them, as commentator Ibn Ezra reminds us, that he's talking to them on the first day of the month. All this conversation between God and Moses is happening as he is pointing out that moon and says, this moon shall be the first moon. And from now on, you're starting to count the months. And this is your responsibility now to count the time, to give the time structure and meaning. And yet he's saying, on this very day, I took you out of Egypt. And as Ibn Ezra explains, this prophecy, it's a prophecy, takes place at the beginning of the month. Its meaning is you will say this in all of your generations. When you eat the matzot, when you celebrate this day of remembrance, when you celebrate this holiday, Pesach, Passover, that I'm giving you the instructions for now, that's when you're going to remember and quote me as saying, on this very day, I took your ranks out of the land of Egypt, etc., etc. In other words, God is telling them already now, you may feel uncertainty right now. You may feel fear as you place the blood of the gods of Egypt on your doors, slaughter them and place them on your doors. But know that the future is already spoken for. I'm giving you spoilers. I'm giving you a trailer. I'm telling you that which humans cannot know. We, living now in March 2020, we don't know how this war is going to end, the war we're watching unfold on the news. We don't know. We can hope, we can pray, but we don't know. The Israelites are told, you will know. This crisis that you're about to reach the apex of, it's not just going to end with you coming out of Egypt. It's going to end with your children and your children's children for many, many, many generations, forever and ever, being able to celebrate as this great celebration, this great and solemn celebration, the moment of deliverance that's about to come your way. Imagine the comfort this offers. Imagine the feeling of confidence that such a strong statement from God can gift to the people who now need to risk themselves. If only the refuseniks in Russia had such a sense of confidence, if only they could have been gifted the knowledge that the Soviet Union will collapse and they will come out eventually, but they couldn't. Usually in history, we can't. And yet here, God intervenes in history to give us this comfort. Except that what he gives us is so much more than comfort. Excuse me. What he gives us is also the gift of identity and meaning and self. And he does it not directly, not in his own words, but rather, I should say not he does it, but rather it happens in the way Moses passes the comfort on to us. Because when Moses comes to the people and tells them to do all these things, to count the days, to take the lambs, to slaughter the lambs, he doesn't only tell them, and one day we will have a holiday. He reframes this holiday. He takes this promise that God made, this solemn promise, and he imbues it into one of the most basic functions of human life, telling stories to our children. Let's look at it together. When God said, when Moses speaks to the people, he says, Moses then summoned all the elders of Israel and said to them, go pick out lambs, etc., etc. And then in verse 25, and when you enter the land that God will give you as promised, you shall observe this riot. And when your children ask you, what do you mean by this riot? Ma avadazot lachem, you shall say, it is the Passover sacrifice to God who passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt when smiting the Egyptians that saved their houses. Those assembled then bowed low in homage. This is a remarkable moment because God didn't say that. This is Moshe stepping forward, finding his own voice, the same Moshe who spoke before about not being a man of words, of worrying that the people are not going to listen to him, of feeling that he can't bring them into liberty. The same Moshe steps forward and adapts God's instructions in a way that shows his keen understanding of the people he is talking to, his keen understanding of the kind of words they need to hear and the kind of words that one day they will need to speak. Because Moshe takes this idea of liberty, this idea of a historical event that's about to happen and the promise of it, and puts it in the intimate human scale context of family life. You can tell a nation of slaves, one day your children will remember this and celebrate your victory, and it might encourage them, and it might inspire them, and it might give them the courage they need to put the gods of their enemies to death. But think about coming to a slave who watched their children thrown into the Nile, who had no power to defend against that, and telling them, one day you will have a conversation with your child. And your child will come to you with a question, and you will have such an inspiring answer to give. It takes God's grand promise, and it makes it intimate and impactful and something that every person can take in through their own personal private lives. Just like God is asking the Israelites to act individually together, Moses is giving them a comfort they will attain individually together, each in their own home. Again, echoing the idea that God's gift to them will be homes, not just a nation, not just a people, not just a land, also homes, families. I have a friend who's a descendant of African slaves who were brought to America in the 1700s. And she doesn't know her family history until the Civil War. She knows about the generation of the Civil War, and she can't trace them back past that. And she feels that loss very keenly, that feeling of not being able to trace who you are and where you're from. But it's more than that. As she told me, and as I heard from others, the idea that a parent can't control what will happen to their children was one of the worst aspects of slavery for people throughout history. And it breaks my friend's heart thinking back to her great-great-great-great-grandmother giving birth to children and not knowing where they're going to be sold to and what's going to happen to them, and not being able to pass any of her own heritage onto them. So you come to the Israelites, this nation of slaves, and you tell them one day, you will tell your children and they will tell theirs. And this takes the promise and the comfort to a whole other level. Moses does it again, by the way, in case we think it's a fluke that God made a general instruction and then Moses made it about stories. Moses does it again later in the text. Let's look at it together. God gives the following instructions. God spoke further to Moses saying, consecrate to me every male firstborn, human and beast. The first male issue of every womb among the Israelites is mine. How does Moses explain it to the people? And Moses said to the people, remember this day on which you went free from Egypt, the house of bondage, how God freed you from it with a mighty hand, etc., etc., etc. And then he says, I'm jumping to verse 6. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a festival of God, and you shall explain to your child on that day, it is because of what God did for me when I went free from Egypt. And this shall serve you as a sign on your hand and as a reminder on your forehead, the tefillin that we wear, in order that the teaching of God may be in your mouth, and with a mighty hand God freed you from Egypt, etc., etc. And then he gets to God's instruction about the firstborn. And when God has brought you into the land of the Canaanites, as God swore to you and to your fathers and has given it to you, you shall set apart for God every first issue of womb, every male firstling that your cattle drop shall be God's, etc. And when in time to come a child of yours asks you, saying, what does this mean about this practice of giving God the firstborn? You shall reply, it was with a mighty hand that God brought us out from Egypt, the house of bondage. After Purim, we'll be pivoting a little bit and seeing how the story of the Exodus is also used in the Passover Haggadah, in the way we learn the Haggadah, in the way we remember the story. And we will see that all these mentions by Moses of the future questions of the children are integrated into the story of the four sons. They're all quoted, not in a matching way. The questions and the answers don't match. They don't align with what we see in the book of Exodus. The authors of the Haggadah took a question from here and an answer from here and put them together. But Moshe's instruction on how we should tell the story becomes key to the way we actually physically tell the story. In other words, and here's a thought for you, when God gives the Israelites this comfort and this promise, and when Moses translates it into storytelling terms and tells them, you shall tell your children, we are the fulfillment of that promise. When we sit on Passover and tell the story, we are those whose lives and faiths gave courage to the Israelites, not knowing us personally, of course, but still, gave courage to the Israelites to kill the gods of Egypt and place the blood on their doors. We're part of the story. We have room in this story already, as it is written in Exodus. But we'll come back to that later in the later classes of this course. What I want to point out now is that by giving them a story to tell, Moses does so much more than offering the Israelites comfort. He does so much more than just giving them the courage or the push they need at this moment. He is also giving them power over the narrative of their life. Until this moment, the Israelites were the things that were done to them. From this moment on, they are the people who tell a story. And as we know from our history, they become the people who tell the story very well and at great length and over again and for millennia to come. And no matter where we were historically and no matter how much we suffered and how much we were persecuted and where we were exiled to or banished from and what privations were visited on us, there are always Jews telling the story, keeping the spirit of the Jewish people alive through it all, wherever we were, wherever we were in art. And this gives us an enormous boost of power, of agency, and of freedom. This course is called The Ins and Outs of Freedom. What we've been exploring so far is how God is trying to liberate the Jews, not just in the sense of getting them out of Egypt, but in giving them the psychological means to be free people. He does it by forcing them to kill their fear as they place the blood on the doors, and we will watch the continuation of that project next week with the Red Sea, with the parting of the sea. And he does it by giving them mastery over the way they understand and explain themselves. In trauma treatment today, it's very common to work with patients, and I'm not a psychologist, I'm just sharing what I read and learned from people who are. It's very common to focus on helping and empowering the victim of trauma, a person suffering from trauma, to rearrange their own story, to tell the story of those events that left a legacy of trauma and pain in their life in a way that they can make sense of, that means something to them. This practice that's become so commonplace, that's portrayed in popular culture and people do it just by themselves and there's a lot of, and become almost metaphor in certain circles to certain things, the reason it's so powerful is that it liberates us. It gives us mastery over how we give meaning, assign meaning to things in our life. By telling the Jews, here is how you're going to tell your story. You will have a story to tell and you will have children who will want to know it and you will have the opportunity to tell it. Moses is offering them a taste of mastery, a taste of that form of psychological liberty that comes from being the person shaping the meaning of your life. But what we see here goes beyond the liberty of a person telling a story, because stories do more than help a person make sense of their life. They also form the common ground of a nation. They also form the backbone of our identity. And without this identity, how can we be a sovereign nation? How can we practice freedom, not on an individual level, but as a group? If we go back to the days before the existence of the State of Israel, there are places in the world where Jews were persecuted. There are places in the world where Jews had rights. But there was no place in the world where Jews were a sovereign group over themselves. People could be part of the sovereign in democracies in America and Canada, in some parts of Europe, but there was a form of liberty that can only be accomplished when Jews as such are sovereign. Today, we are lucky to live in a world where we have so many options and so many forms of freedom. But when God is getting the Jews out of Egypt, he's not merely trying to give them personal freedom. He wants them to taste that other freedom too. He wants them to go and shape a society that's shaped by Jewish law, by Jewish story. And the first step in order to achieve that, he needs to give them a sense of self as such, as a people. If you recall, in our first class, we discussed the beginning of the book of Exodus. And we saw how in the very, very beginning of the book of Exodus, the first thing we lose is not freedom, it's our names. We start by being named Yosef, Yehuda, Issachar, Zvulun, etc. And then suddenly we start talking about these vague sons of Israel that multiply almost like natural force. And there's no names in the story until Moshe rises later on. Before we can achieve our freedom as a people, we need to remember that we are a people, that we are a group. And this is where that ability to tell stories comes in. And I feel like I'm butchering a little bit the point here. So I would like to turn to someone whose eloquence is legendary and ability to convey this idea is amazing, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, in an article called The Story We Tell. I'm here at box number 6. Why was this the most important thing he could do in the intense moment of redemption, namely give us the stories that we will tell? Because freedom is the work of a nation. Nations need identity. Identity needs memory. And memory is encoded in the stories we tell. Without narrative, there is no memory. And without memory, we have no identity. The most powerful link between the generations is the tale of those who came before us, a tale that becomes ours, and that we then and that we hand on as a sacred heritage to those who will come after us. We are the story we tell ourselves about ourselves, and identity begins in the story parents tell to their children. That narrative provides the answer, that narrative meaning the narrative of the Exodus, provides the answer to the three fundamental questions every reflective individual must ask at some stage in their lives. Who am I? Why am I here? How then shall I live? There are many answers to these questions, but the Jewish ones are, I am a member of a people whom God rescued from slavery to freedom. I am here to build a society that honors the freedom of others, not just my own. And I must live in conscious knowledge that freedom is a gift of God, honored by keeping his covenant of law and love. In other words, by giving us these stories, the seeds of the future way we tell the story to this day, Moses is giving the people comfort, is giving the people a sense of mastery of their own personal narrative, and is giving them a sense of identity that will enable them to pursue political freedom as a nation and not as individuals. But he offers them something else as well. And here we come back to the question I asked earlier today about why the first commandment has to do with time. Why is the first commandment look at the moon, declare the moon, control the moon, do something related to this moon and to the month and to the counting of the days? Why? Why start there? Why not say, if we keep talking about the connection between generations, why shouldn't the first commandment be Kabed et avicha ve et imecha, right? Honor your father and mother. Why shouldn't it be that first commandment of the 10 commandments that we will reach in a few weeks? I am God. Don't have any other gods other than me. You would think it's kind of fitting, right? It's fitting with the idea of, it fits with them killing the gods of Egypt. There's some nice parallel here, and like declare that I am God and believe in it and kill the gods of Egypt, right? But no, the first has to do with time. And to understand why time is so important. And I see already people are writing in the comments that slaves have no control of their time, of their schedule, of their way they shape their life in order to carry out their intentions and how they prioritize how they use their time. This is all very true. So this is a taste of freedom that a slave can't even imagine. But I want to go another step beyond that. And I want to point out that when Moses tells them, one day you will say, on this day I took the Jews out of Egypt, right? He is turning their present into a certain future's past. Let's let that sink for a second. He is forcing them, in other words, to think beyond the moment, not to be stuck where they are right now in this moment in history, but to think of this moment as part of a longer series of moments that have a certain meaning and a certain structure to them and a certain heft and a certain flavor. And suddenly that place in history that they're standing in is no longer their, that's it, face all, the end all of your existence. It's just another stage in a much, much, much broader context. And this liberates them in a sense, because it liberates them from whatever happens right now. Slaves have to deal with whatever happens right now. If the master is walking by you with a lash, you can't think about philosophy. You need to think about how not to draw attention. If you don't have food to feed your children, you can't think about how in two generations people are going to celebrate your deliverance. You need to think about how to get food for your children right now. Slavery strips us down to below the bottom layer of Maslow's famous pyramid of needs. You're perpetually in a place of no safety, no security, in every basic need. You can't think beyond that, or you sometimes can, but you're taking a risk by thinking beyond that. God is inviting the people, and Moses following him and making it more intimate by adding the element of story is elaborating on that. God is inviting them to think past the slave's time frame, past the next meal, past the next flogging, past the next task that somebody else set for you. He is setting them free to think of time as something they can shape, something that has meaning, something that has rhythm. And the truth is that this particular act of redemption is not relevant only for the Jews of Egypt. This is a gift that God, in a sense, gives us for all generations to come. I want to highlight this or formulate it a bit better by bringing an idea from a book that has nothing to do with Exodus on the face of it, Robert Gruden's Time and the Art of Living, a very beautiful book of reflections about time and the way we live with time and how we shape it. Gruden is a Christian. He's not referencing Moses or the Exodus at any place. And yet his big obsession throughout this book is with the idea of liberty and how the way we live with time, the way we perceive of time, is deeply related to liberty. And I want to read parts of this quote here. We're not going to read the whole thing. And just to give a little bit of context, what Gordon is talking about is how we tend to be stuck in the present. We tend to be stuck in the moment we're living through. Like a machine which sorts out a great variety of objects into individually homogeneous bundles, time sorts and garners up our various productions. We smoke only one cigarette at a time, but in a few years, our lungs look as though we had inhaled a volcano. We experience isolated moments of affection and delight and find in a few weeks that we are in love, yet we seldom think of a specific phenomena as parts of a coherent whole. In other words, looking from the side at our life, we can see certain themes, we can see certain repeated motifs. But if we're too focused on the present, if we don't take the broader view, if we don't look from the side, we don't see all those connections. We don't see those rhythms. We just experience whatever it is with our experience, and it's small. It's not very large. It's not very broad. I'm jumping a little bit ahead. And in missing the incremental structure, the temporal coherence of our lives, we miss the truth about ourselves. Just like stories help us have an identity, a sense of who we are, so does looking at time, not only from the perspective of the future, helps us explain to ourselves who we are, what we want to be, tell ourselves, do we want to be that or do we want to change the way we live our lives? All of those things are very hard to do when all you think about is the past. Free men and women, on the other hand, can think across time, viewing their own lives, inclusive of past, present, and future, as architectural whole, static, and a mental space. They can therefore see, as others cannot, the crux and buttresses of repeated actions, the points of stress, the established framework. By giving us control over time, by giving us a sense of the future that will give meaning to our present once our present becomes a past, God is giving us the keys to that broader, more intentional way of looking at time. And in that more intentional way of looking at time, we also find a more masterful way of planning our time, of managing our lives, of telling our stories, and of making it all coherent together instead of living in the moment in a way that even without a taskmaster's walking past you with a lash means that who we are and what we want doesn't come into expression in our lives. And this is the gift that Moses and God give the Jews on the eve of their liberation. I will take a few of your questions from the chat, but before that, I just want to read one last passage, since here we are actually reaching the Exodus, so let us reach it together. In the middle of the night, God struck down all the male firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Paro who sat on the throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, etc., etc. And Paro arose in the night with all his courtiers and all the Egyptians, because there was a loud cry in Egypt, for there was no house where there was not someone dead. He summoned Moses and Aaron in the night and said, "Up! Depart from amongst my people, you and the Israelites with you. Go, worship God, as you said. Take also your flocks and your herds, as you said, and be gone. And may you bring a blessing upon me too." The Egyptians urged the people on, impatient to have them leave the country, for they said, "We shall all be dead." So the people took their dough before it was leavened, their kneading bowls wrapped in their cloaks upon their shoulders. The Israelites had done Moses' bidding and borrowed from the Egyptians objects of silver and golden clothing. I'm jumping a little bit ahead. The Israelites journeyed from Ramses to Sukkot, about 600,000 fighting men on foot, aside from non-combatants. And here we already see a very deep symbolism involved in the story. We talked before about how Ramses means child of Ra, child of the god Ra. And Ramses III, who we believe is the Paro of our story, made himself into a god. He built temples to himself. And here they are living the city that's named after that, that named after this idea of Egypt, that the god is like a king, the king is like a god, and all should be done as he says, and he is the ultimate power. Where are they traveling to? To Sukkot, to huts, to something that is not a temple that's meant to stay forever, not some Ozymandias statue in the middle of the desert, but rather something that you build and break and build and break and expresses constant motion, constant traveling, constant growth, and the ability to change who you are and be in motion instead of being stuck in the Ramses world of Egypt. And so they go and they make their food. And we sum up in verse 51, that very day God freed the Israelites from the land of Egypt, troop by troop. As we will see in the lessons to come, he may have taken them out of Egypt, but taking Egypt out of them is going to take a little bit longer. And some of the issues we already saw God addressing, namely the issue of time, the issue of fear, freedom from fear, the issue of taking initiative, are issues that God will have to keep addressing over and over again with Moshe's help in the following, in the desert, and in between. See all that. I think the worst moment in that moment of redemption where where everything we've seen built so far comes to fruition on this grand scale. And now let's look at the questions for a moment. Sima Hertzberg is asking an excellent question. Why is the term borrowed used rather than take? Presumably about borrowing gold and silver from the Egyptians. This is an excellent question, and we'll address it next time. So stay tuned. just a minute. Tova Shimon pointed out that when God tells them about the blood, he says, the sign is for you, not for me. I, God, don't need it. You need it. And I agree. It's a good fine point. And it's also fits very well with what we're talking about how it's a way for them to liberate themselves from fear. Lauren Blatt wrote, so when we say at the Seder that we eat matzah because the Israelites didn't have time for the bread to leaven before they left Egypt, it's incorrect. Hashem told them to eat unleavened bread before they left. This is an excellent point. There's this weird thing that's happening here. We're told two things. We're told that they didn't have time. In the passage we just read now at the end of the story, that they didn't have time to leaven the bread. And we're also told that God told them in advance to celebrate this day by eating unleavened bread. This is only one case of a much broader phenomena, in a sense, and that is the phenomena of the duality of Passover. Passover is described to us, and it's hard for me to do it justice in a very short amount of time, but we learn about the Exodus in the book of Exodus, then we learn about it from the perspective of time in the book of Deuteronomy. And two times we get the sets of instructions about what exactly to do with Pesach. And even here already, we get two versions on why exactly we eat the unleavened bread. One way to address that is I feel like it's a little bit of a cop-out way, but I'll share it because it's a commonly viewed as true, is that God knew in advance they're not going to have time to leaven their bread, and therefore God is already giving them the sign now, but later after it happens, they'll be like, oh, that's why God said that. So that's one answer. I want to take that answer and dig a little deeper into it and give it a little bit of a deeper context or a little bit of a more depth, because the truth is that the way we celebrate Passover combines accepting God's perspective of the story and following God's instructions on how we're supposed to celebrate the story, and at the same time, taking ownership of the story and doing it our human way. As we already saw, Moses is the first to do that. Moses is the first to take God's instructions and pass them on faithfully to the people, but also intertwine them in, do it as a story when your children ask you. It's like he takes these grand instructions and puts them on the human scale. Then every year on Passover, we do the same thing. You know, at the time of the temple, we had the Korban Pesach that followed the instructions, the offering followed the instructions from the Torah. The main thing we do now is telling the story. And we tell the story in a way that is completely composed by humans and focuses on what the humans think is the important bits of the story. So there's a certain element, and if you think about Passover as a holiday where God liberated us, it makes sense that we have that duality, because God did it, and we keep emphasizing that God himself did it, not a messenger, not an angel, etc., just God. But he liberated us, so now we're free. Now we have to shape the story. Now we have to take all of that and give it meaning. So in a sense, this tension in the story between, wait a minute, is the unleavened bread we eat because God said so, or because we ourselves had that experience that we remember now? I'm not saying it resolves that tension, but it almost gives it a broader sense. And if you remind me, when we reach our last class in this course, where we're going to take everything we learned and see how it appears in Haggadah Shel Pesach, we'll address that again there. A moment. Zahav Gold pointed out regarding stories. This is Yuval Harari's point in his book about Homo sapiens. He asked why a weaker animal, namely us, can defeat stronger animals like lions and tigers and bears, oh my. And he says that the way we adapt and I'm changing the wording here a little, just addressing it. Thank you for this point, Zahab. The way we adapt is by telling stories, and the telling stories, the storytelling animal aspect of humanity allows us to create more complex society, a stronger sense of memory, pass more information, and therefore outperform species where the individual members of the species are much, much stronger than our own, than ourselves. Unfortunately, we are ran out here, so we have to, I ran out of time, but I just wanted to say one last thought, just to tie everything together. We saw how God liberates us from fear. More accurately, how God invites us to liberate ourselves from fear. God can't take the fear away. We have to do it. We saw how God invites us to take charge of our own narrative. And we saw how God offers us a story, or more accurately, Moses offers us a story to become a people that can then pursue freedom as a political movement. I want to go back to the first point, the point about fear, and say that while most of us didn't experience a totalitarian regime, I don't know, maybe some of you also are from the Soviet Union and have experienced it in your life. I definitely did not. Fear can take many forms, and being enslaved by fear can be true also in a free society where we fear disapprobation by our neighbors and not persecution by the government. And whenever I read these verses about the Jews and their hands covered in blood and putting the blood on the walls, all I pray for is that I'll be worthy of being their descendants, and I too will act by what is right and not by what is prudent due to fear. And with that thought, may we see our redemption in our own time. May we be zoche, may we merit to participate in it in those ways we can. And I will see you all next week. Thank you so much, and good news.